Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, are veterans close to getting the health coverage they need for exposure to toxic burn pits? Also, the plight of the bald eagle. After coming back from the brink of extinction, our national bird is now threatened by lead poisoning. But to begin today's show, we're talking about the trial of former Amtrak engineer Brandon Bostian, who was found not guilty Friday of causing catastrophe, involuntary manslaughter, and reckless endangerment in the deadly Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia nearly 7 years ago. According to a federal investigation, train 188 exceeded a speed of 100 miles per hour as it entered a curve near Frankfurt Junction May 12th of 2015. The speed limit was 50, and the resulting accident killed 8 people and injured nearly 200. Bostian was highly regarded as an engineer, called one of the best at Amtrak by one expert witness, and so a main focus at the trial had been his state of mind at the time of the accident. The verdict came fairly quickly. It took jurors less than an hour and a half to reach the verdict. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has been covering proceedings for us, and she's here with us now. Hi, Laura.
Good morning, Mary.
So Brandon Bostian was acquitted of all charges. Initially, Laura, it didn't seem as if this case would even be brought to trial. Why not, and what changed?
There was a long disagreement about whether or not there was enough evidence to bring criminal charges. So at the time of the derailment, the then district attorney, Seth Williams, sort of looked at all of the evidence and passed on that opportunity. You know, he put out a statement basically saying this doesn't meet the bar that you have to meet in terms of evidence a crime occurred and that this person likely did it to bring a trial. But, you know, this was a horrendous accident. 8 people died, and many people had their lives changed forever. So attorneys representing some of the victims and estates of those who died ended up filing a private criminal complaint in 2017. And the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office took that up, and there continued to be some debate in the courts about basically whether or not this case could meet that minimum standard. But in 2020, the Pennsylvania Superior Court ruled yes, there's enough here. Prosecutors have enough evidence. They can bring this case before a jury.
The National Transportation Safety Board investigated. What did it find regarding Bostian's actions that night?
So the NTSB report looked at all facets of the incident, what could have gone wrong, what could have been better in terms of safety measures, and they really dug into Bostian as a part of that. They looked at whether or not he was on drugs or alcohol. He wasn't. Whether or not he was on his phone. His phone was powered off. Whether or not he was somehow asleep or incapacitated. And again, no evidence of that. So what they ended up writing in their report is that the most likely reason he failed to slow for that curve, that sharp Frankfurt Junction curve, is that he believed he was in a different stretch of track. Right after that curve, there's a straightaway where you can accelerate to 110 miles per hour. That's the speed limit there. So they say he lost his quote-unquote situational awareness, which is basically, you know, knowing where you are, because his attention was distracted. There had been these radio transmissions from a SEPTA engineer whose train was struck by a projectile, and that engineer's windshield had shattered. So there was glass thrown in that engineer's face, and there'd been about 6 minutes of radio transmissions where they discussed that incident and whether the engineer needed medical attention. So the NTSB said that is what probably distracted Bostian.
What did Brandon Bostian tell investigators of his experience?
Bostian cooperated. He sat with investigators for 2 separate interviews. The first was a couple days after the derailment. And at that time, he didn't recall very much. Bostian was hit on the head as a part of the derailment. He had a concussion and received 14 stitches on his head. So at that time, he just said, you know, I remember passing the North Philadelphia Amtrak station, and then the next thing is just coming to after the train was off the track. You know, several months later, he sat again for an interview with investigators. That was in November 2015. And at that point, he said a couple of prominent scenes had come back, although he said they were, quote unquote, dreamlike. And he couldn't be totally sure if he was confusing memories of that night or another night he was on the same route. But he says he does remember accelerating. So the speed limit right before the Frankfurt curve was about 80 miles per hour. And he says he remembered, oh, I'm going 70. I need to speed up. I need to get to 80 to, you know, hit my timetables to get to the stops on time. And so he remembered that. And then he remembered in the second interview with investigators, realizing the train was going too fast and trying to brake and realizing it wasn't going to be enough and that the train was going to go off the rails.
So he was determined to have been clean, no drugs or alcohol. He wasn't on his phone at the time. And his driving record prior to the derailment, Laura, what was that like?
There were several experts who testified, including someone who had trained Boston, you know, that his record was clean. They reviewed his performance earlier in that evening. They reviewed his performance along that exact corridor between New York and D.C., which he had done, you know, dozens of times recently before the derailment. And they found him to be essentially perfect. You know, he followed the rules. He knew where he was in every other instance except for this one.
So the jury did hear from some victims of the derailment or their families. What did they have to say about the experience?
You know, they just sort of hit home how tragic and disconcerting it was. The first passenger that the jury heard from was a woman named Blair Berman. She was returning to New York after visiting her parents in the Philly suburbs for Mother's Day on that night. And she testified, you know, she could feel the train starting to go off the tracks. It was tilting and tilting, and she sort of realized, though, there's no correction coming. This is it. You know, something is wrong. And she was severely injured in the derailment. You know, she testified she came to, and there were three people pinning her back leg down.
Oh, gosh.
She later, you know, was sent to the hospital, and it turned out her heel bone in her foot, one of her feet, was crushed, and her elbow was also injured. And so she had to do about 2 years of physical therapy to recover from her injuries, and she just talked about how life-changing that was. And then there was another victim's family member, Charles Gildersleeve, who testified, and his brother Robert had been on the train and was actually one of the last two people identified by authorities. And so Charles just testified to, you know, this horrible feeling, not being able to get in touch with his brother, and then the realization slowly setting in that his brother was gone.
One of the worst derailments in this country's history.
Did
Amtrak admit responsibility in any way, shape, or form?
They did, and pretty immediately Amtrak admitted liability. And they went into this enormous sort of structured settlement with all of the victims. So they've set aside $265 million, so more than $250 million, one of the largest ever settlements for a passenger rail incident, to go to, you know, the families of the eight people who died, as well as the, you know, around 200 people who were injured. And part of that is because there was evidence, you know, to system failures in this crash. The National Transportation Safety Board found that some of the safety equipment standards weren't adequate. Things like stronger windows on the cars could have prevented some death and injury. And they also pointed to a kind of system-wide failure around this automatic braking technology.
PTC, yeah.
That's right. Positive train control. So there's been similar technology in the past, and this is sort of the latest version of basically a dummy brake, you know, taking it out of the engineer's hands to slow down in the right place. And Congress had mandated it, but it was not installed. And one of the things that the federal investigation found is that that definitely could have prevented the derailment.
How quickly did it take Amtrak to install PTC?
So it had been called for decades prior to this derailment and other derailments. And it took a few more years after 2015 for it to be fully installed, but it is now in place. It's on that curve. And so essentially we wouldn't have this incident again because of positive train control.
And worth noting, Laura, that in recent years, NJ Transit has implemented positive train control on its systems, and SEPTA's regional rails have positive train control as well.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the train engineers who are testifying for the defense. They talked about the human factor, how it might play into the job of an engineer. When it comes to situational awareness, Laura, did they say that there's any specific protocol for somebody to follow, or even, co-engineers or co-workers to help with if this sort of thing happens?
You know, this is a big subject of debate because, you know, the jury just had to understand what happened in Bastian's mind. So the prosecution and defense called all of these expert, highly experienced engineers to talk about what it's like to be in that seat, to be in command of a train, and what it means to lose track of where you are. So, you know, on the prosecution side, they basically tried to show that, look, people throw stuff at trains all the time. This is an extremely common occurrence. It's I would say almost like a regular distraction. And so in that way, engineers like Boston should have been prepared to deal with it. But on the other side, you know, the engineers who testified said, we're not actually trained. We're not given a specific protocol for how to deal with this. Yeah, we know it's common. We know it's a fact of our job. We deal with it. But there was this sort of gap in the training that was pointed out that, you know, people maybe need to be specifically prepared for this so that they don't lose track of where they are. And the other thing that came across is some of the other engineers who testified said, you know, it does happen. As highly trained as we are, as much as we have to memorize every single, you know, speed change or track curve on our route, we do sometimes lose track of where we are. And yeah, and that, you know, there is room for error a little bit.
The human factor, which indeed is in this case, can lead to a terrible and tragic accident. So Brandon Bastian had rejected a plea deal. What would that have involved had he said okay to this?
I'm not quite positive on the details. What they had tried to do was sort of get rid of one of the classes of charges to have him plead guilty to causing catastrophe, if I remember correctly. But, you know, this was essentially to get him to take some charges, plead guilty to something so that he wouldn't have exposed himself to quite as much prison time. Now, obviously, he was acquitted, so he's not getting any. But, you know, it was an attempt by prosecutors to sort of head off the trial at the pass.
Yeah, if convicted, I think he would have been behind bars for life, potentially.
That is what the judge said, yeah.
So what happens next for Brandon Bastian, Laura? Do we know?
That's a good question. You know, I spoke with an attorney for some of the victims who's not the prosecutor in this case. His name's Tom Klein. He helped manage that massive settlement with Amtrak. And he seemed to think that this was the end of the line, you know, that there would not be more legal action brought. But again, the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office did not speak on Friday, and their statement said that they would respect the decision of the jury.
Okay.
This could be it. This could be the end of this legal case.
Okay. Got about a minute left. So just very quickly, I'd like to touch base on a pandemic-related story you reported on a short while ago. There is some encouraging news from the tourism and hospitality industries in Philly, Laura?
That's right. You know, there was a big hotel study that the city put out earlier this year that, you know, hotel occupancy is increasing again. And tourism, hospitality, and leisure, these are the industries that completely bottomed out due to COVID. And so, well, they're modest gains, but it does look like some of these industries, you know, no other wave willing, no more Omicron, no whatever comes after that.
Yeah.
There could be a full recovery in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a developing story, and I'm sure we'll all keep an eye on it. Laura Benchoff, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Benchoff reports for WHYY News and was reporting on the Amtrak trial for us. Up next on the regional roundup, we talk about a legislation just passed by the U.S. House of Representatives that would help veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Veterans groups are hailing Thursday's passage of the Honoring Our Pact Act by the House of Representatives as a significant step forward in the battle for comprehensive health care. It's estimated that 3.5 million service members were exposed to toxic burn pits and other environmental hazards in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other deployments. And many of them today are suffering serious and even deadly health issues, including cancers, autoimmune disease, and respiratory disorders. Experts say there is a connection between such toxin exposure and severe illness, and the legislation would significantly expand eligibility for health care coverage as it relieves vets of the burden of trying to prove their military service was connected to these serious health issues. We have two guests joining us now to weigh in on this legislation. Kelly Kennedy is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of The War Horse. She broke the burn pit story in 2008, and she is a combat veteran. Kelly Kennedy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And Chad Baer is an Army National Guard veteran and burn pit and toxic exposure advocate who now lives in Chester County. Chad, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So let's start by talking about the experience of these burn pits. Chad, to you first. Tell us what they look like and about the odor and the atmosphere around them.
So that's actually a great lead-in because it's different every time, and that's part of the problem. So my experience is very different than many other veterans. So for me, I didn't see it. I didn't see the burning. It just so happened that whatever it was that they were burning, whatever they were doing, would kind of blow onto the running trail, which was dirt. And there was a certain location where I worked overnight with a small group, and that's when they would burn. And it would blow apparently downwind or settle where we were. And we would work in this sort of haze and smoke. And this was many years ago, and I distinctly remember just the feeling of it burning my eyes and throat all night.
Were you and fellow service members actively thinking about potential health effects while these burns were underway?
No, not really. We were focused on our jobs, and you know, we just kind of laughed it off that it couldn't be good. And at a certain point while I was there, I believe they halted mandatory runs on the trail because there was a congressional inquiry or something along those lines. And it didn't really hit home until the end of my time overseas, which was about 7 months, and I had been running roughly 7 minute, 30 second mile, about a 15 minute 2 mile, sometimes better, when I got in country. And by the time I left, I failed my first PT test that I think I ever failed. I couldn't run 2 miles in under 19 minutes or so.
Wow!
And I was wheezing, and I just couldn't finish.
So what was the eventual diagnosis for you, and how are your lungs?
So it's another interesting question. The official diagnosis I have so far is asthma. I have exercise-induced asthma, and they haphazardly found nodules in my lungs that we had to monitor for several years. Fortunately, they do not seem to have grown. And I have sort of this host of issues of shortness of breath, and I have this chronic inflammation in my throat that we can't figure out. So it's kind of ongoing.
Is it concerning?
Yeah, it's very concerning. I've got young kids, and I meet these veterans on the Hill when I go down there, and I meet these folks that are dying. And, it's worrisome that I won't be there to watch my kids grow up, which these other veterans are not.
Kelly Kennedy, as you report in your work, troops and contractors, foreign nationals and journalists were exposed to the same contaminants in these toxic burn pits as the first responders to the 9/11 attacks. Tell us about the contaminants.
Yeah, sure. So Epaulet Air Base, which was the biggest burn pit in 2008, they were burning 240 tons of trash in an open pit at one point. And that included everything from medical waste to foreign national medical waste. I don't know if that matters, but that was a thing. Styrofoam containers from the mess hall. It was unexploded ordnance. They were using jet fuel to set it on fire, and someone at some point made the connection that these guys were going in and facing basically the same thing that the first responders were facing, which was this big open burning pit filled with building materials and styrofoam and electronics. And but while the 9/11 veterans' health effects were being tracked, ours weren't necessarily being tracked for the military. Hmm. So yeah, that was sort of when things started moving along, when that connection was made.
You wrote a few years back of retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Bowers, who'd suffered from severe headaches for months after he got home from Joint Base Balad. He said virtually everyone on base had some version of plume crud. What was that?
Yeah, so I think at Balad, because it was such a big pit, and because the troops were living so close to it, they were only a mile downwind of it, they would do things like put wet towels over their air conditioner at night, and they'd wake up in the morning and the towel would be pitch black. And I think that they realized pretty quickly that they were being exposed to something bad. And everyone talked about the plume crud. It was, everyone had a cough. Everyone had, you know, problems with their eyes. They'd go to sick call and they'd be told that they just had, you know, a respiratory infection. And if you look at the data for those years, the respiratory infections just went up astronomically.
What was the initial response of the Veterans Administration here?
Yeah, so it's kind of a fascinating story. There was a public affairs, military personnel, public affairs guy named Dan Clare, who was trying to get the story out. And journalists were sort of responding by, like, this sounds crazy, that can't be true. And he anonymously leaked it to me, to us at Army Times when I was there. And we started writing about it. And the initial response from both DOD and VA was that there was no known health effects, which made no sense because you can't burn trash in your backyard. And if you're a firefighter, you wear all this gear. And the gear isn't just to protect you from burning, it's to protect your lungs from particulate matter. Yeah. So there was this colonel, Darren Curtis, who sent out a memo after he assessed the environmental health hazards at Balad and said there was an acute health hazard. So their own people were saying that there were problems, but it's such a big money issue that it just couldn't move forward. It was sort of unbelievable, and I think everyone who was involved knew that the fallout was going to be incredible from this.
One of the big issues was the chemical which was used to produce Agent Orange, the notorious herbicide used in the Vietnam War, that's dioxin. And dioxin was found to be present in, I guess, the smoke from these toxic burn pits that post-9/11 vets were exposed to. Chad, what is, when you hear this sort of thing and you know the historical reluctance of the DOD and the VA to address this, what has gone through your mind as a veteran?
It's been infuriating. I as I was undergoing my initial lung scans and reading some of the research that they continued to point to over the years and saying it's inconclusive. And it's a false narrative, honestly. It really is, because we know that these things have a host of deleterious health ramifications, right? We know you can't go burn plastic, you can't burn your refrigerator, and you can't do that because it causes cancer. It causes a wide variety of issues. And what it is they're saying, we need more research because we didn't keep good records of what we burned and when it was exposed. So we're going to have to keep doing research. It's not that the exposures weren't toxic. It's that they didn't maintain their records to have what they want, conclusive research. And it's kind of unbelievable. And you see the narrative shift right now. You see it shift to, we need more research, we need more research. And then it becomes, well, the VA just can't handle it. And I find that to be kind of immoral, to say that we're just not going to take care of our sick veterans because now we're saying the VA can't handle it. And that's, yeah.
Chad, did President Biden's mention of this and his reference to his late son, Beau, during the State of the Union address resonate and offer hope that this issue will move forward more quickly. And, of course, there's also the legislation. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about President Biden, his address first, and then to you, Kelly. So, Chad, you first.
Yeah, I have a lot of hope on that. I was down on the Hill in November with John Stewart and all the VSOs, which is I'm really honored to have been there as an individual. It means a lot that they're hearing me. And I know that President Biden takes it personally with Bo's exposure. And unfortunately, right now, it rests in this reconciliation between the House and the Senate. Yeah. And that's a huge step because this presumption issue is really critical. And I think it's a big question mark. What goes to President Biden's desk? And then we revisit it. Because if this inner Senate bill goes to his desk, then I think it's going to resurface back to him and his personal vesting in the issue and how much he cares about it.
So again, the Honoring Our Pact Act has just passed the House of Representatives. The Senate passed similar legislation in February. The bills are not identical. Kelly, as a journalist, are you confident the House and Senate might be able to reconcile these bills to come up with a package that really, truly helps affected veterans? Or is money going to scuttle this, as it seems to have scuttled research efforts in the past?
I think money will scuttle part of it. I think they'll probably go closer with the Senate version, which asks for a direct connection. So, you know, you need to be able to show that you have issues and that they may be related to the burn pits, as opposed to sort of this blanket coverage of everyone who might need help with their issues. I mean, we're talking about, I think they said 3.5 million people. Yeah. It's a lot of people.
So again, veterans under the Senate legislation would have to prove the connection?
They would have to at least have a disability, I think. I don't think the VA is already offering presumption for some of these issues, and Biden has said that he's working toward more, but I think that it would open it up for more people who are sick to have automatic presumption.
So, Chad, for somebody like you who's monitoring nodules on your lungs, are you able now to access the coverage you need? Or is this something that, you know, you don't necessarily want to see the Senate bill confirm because of this? Because then you've got to do some work proving that there's a connection.
I'm a little bit wary of the VA right now because of this lack of accountability and this fight over presumption. I know it's not the VA's fault. But I don't trust it without the presumption because I've, again, been on the Hill with these folks that are sick and dying and watching them fight with the VA to get their health care covered as they're dying. And the VA is denying it. I really don't have any sense of comfort without the presumption because, again, we know these exposures. We know what they do to your health. And this refrain that we need more research, which is what the Senate bill is kicking the can. Yeah. And essentially waiting until so many folks are sick and dead that it's definitive. That's conclusive. That's what the Senate bill is vying for.
Kelly Kennedy, I can't imagine environmental law in the United States would allow anything like these toxic burn pits.
No, they don't. I mean, you can't even have a burn in your backyard of your household garbage. It's against the law.
So are there burn pits in operation today under the auspices of the military?
Yeah, the DOD said as of, I think it was 2018, they still had 9 burn pits going, which is infuriating because after our coverage in 2008, Congress had a series of hearings and demanded that they be shut down and that the military use incinerators. But the incinerators are always breaking down, and the military argues that it's small bases. They don't have the resources and the money to do that. Well, there's money to fight a war. There's money for tanks. Let's think harder about our people.
Kelly Kennedy, do you know if the legislation that was passed by the House provides for families who might lose a service member whose death can be attributed to the toxins from these trash burns?
I think just sort of by default, VA offers benefits to families who lose service members who are a certain percentage of disability. I don't think it addresses specific, but I could be wrong on that.
So Chad Baer, what more needs to be done legislatively for post 9/11 veterans? Obviously, I would gather the legislation that's in front of Congress needs to be perhaps more comprehensive. And if you think that's the case, how so?
So I want to start with the fact that I think that the legislation that the House passed is robust, it's comprehensive. I think it's 128 pages as compared to maybe 16 from Senator or thereabout. And there's a lot there. It does a lot for those that are sick and suffering right now and those who are sick and don't know yet, and they're going to be going through these fights.
Okay.
So I'm very happy with the Honoring Our Pact Act. I have sort of a unique perspective on this with my background in statistics and having lived it. And the other side of the coin is something that's not really talked about very often in D.C., but the VA doesn't have the data to do longitudinal studies of cohorts who had similar exposures. So that's the future state, right? Let's take care of the sick and dying now.
Yeah.
But they want to point to more research. We need to do the real research, and we need to study the cohorts and get ahead of the cancer. So Bo Biden, right? We talk about Bo Biden, and who is checking on the men and women that serve right next to him and under his command who had the same exposures? We're not. We can't right now because the VA doesn't have the data, and they always point to the DOD, and that's the fox in the hen house.
I just want to close with a comment from Rick, who says he was in Vietnam. It took him 43 years to get 100% disability for Agent Orange, and it didn't get it until he had a heart attack and almost died. Here's hoping that the legislation moves quickly through Congress and is comprehensive. And Chad Baer, our pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. And Kelly Kennedy, you as well, Chad Baer. Both are veterans, and we really appreciate your participation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Kelly, you are, of course, the managing editor of The War Horse. Stay tuned. The regional roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The bald eagle was nearly wiped out of existence by the pesticide DDT in the mid to late 20th century. But with dedicated conservation efforts, America's national bird has since made an extraordinary recovery. However, another threat is looming. Bald eagles fish and hunt, but they also like to feast on the carrion left behind by hunters, carcasses and entrails, which can often contain pieces of lead ammunition. Researchers say lead poisoning in these majestic birds can be debilitating, and it is widespread, slowing the population's recovery. There are efforts being made to change the culture around hunting ammunition, efforts proponents say are not anti-hunting. Our guest for the remainder of the hour is Kathleen Clark, supervising biologist for the Endangered and Non-Game Species Program at the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. Kathy Clark, so good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the bald eagle was named our national bird in 1782. What is it about this bird that captivates us?
Oh, well, it's no matter how many times you see it, it's always startling. It just, you just have to watch it. It's a large bird. No other bird like it. Big, dark shape, but the white head and white tail stand out from a distance, and it's just regal.
Yeah. I've read
and
the
it's
wingspan.
Always a thrill to see it.
It is. It's absolutely spectacular, mm-hmm. and you know, huge wingspan. What, 7 feet? I've read. Can you get up to that 7 feet?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just that profile is, you know, very large, almost plank-like, which is different from the more common vultures that have that V shape.
I'd also like to jump in and say, you know, if any of our listeners would like to join us with questions or comments, 888-477-9499 is the number. Email us at radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Kathy, how does an eagle come to ingest lead?
Yeah, so most of the year, eagles prefer to eat fish. And that is, so everything that can be found in the river and the lakes, whether it's fish or eels or even turtles, that is tends to be their preferred foods. But in the winter, things get a little scarce. Fish are not as active or they go to lower depths. So they are really forced to make a living by taking advantage of anything that's out there, and they do definitely turn to carrion. With deer, now so some deer just naturally die during the winter, mm-hmm. And then of course there's the hunting seasons, and some deer are not recovered by hunters. Maybe they just could not be tracked that far. And of course, deer are killed by cars as well. Deer form a pretty important source of food for eagles in the winter. The problem, of course, comes along with deer that have been shot with lead ammunition, because when shot hits a deer, it can fragment into many, many small pieces. Mm. And be found throughout the meat and the organs, and it really takes a very small fragment of lead to cause an acute poisoning for an eagle and even kill it.
How does the poisoning manifest in the bird? What do we see?
It has a neurological effect, and so the bird will be a bird that is. Suffering from lead poisoning is going to be grounded. It does not have very good control of its body. It's can't hold its head up. Fortunately, when people do find these birds, the only good part about it is that the eagle can be captured fairly easily because it just can't get away. If we can get treatment quickly, we can reverse the poisoning with the proper treatment if it happens quickly enough. But those are the cases of an acute poisoning. And as I said, it's a neurologic toxin, just as it is in people. So it has a very severe effect, and it will kill the bird. Yeah. As I said, it does not take very much of a lead fragment that's ingested. Lead goes through the digestive process and becomes broken down and enters the bloodstream. That's affecting the brain and the nervous system, and also the internal organs. So when we measure lead in eagles, we're looking at what is the level in the bloodstream, next what is the level in the liver, and eventually that lead settles somewhere and it actually ends up in the bones as bones grow. It can be measured.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Kathy.
Those are the measures for detecting the level and the long-term toxicity of lead in eagles.
This is actually affecting the recovery of the bald eagle population?
Yes, there's a study just recently released in magazine Science that showed that modeling this out. Of course, they documented the level of lead that was measured in over 1,200 bald and golden eagles. And what it boiled down to was the modeling indicated that these levels of lead that were found in bald and golden eagles boil down to a slower growth, slowing the rate of population growth by about 1% to 4% each year.
Which is significant.
It's significant. It's quite a while, quite a ways that is dropping the existing growth rate. I mean, we've been really lucky that Eagles have responded, you know, post-DDT. There's been a lot of hands-on management to manage proactively, to bring them back to where they are today. Nesting, we had over 220 pairs last year in New Jersey. In Pennsylvania, I think they just recently delisted them on the state level.
Okay.
But this is an ongoing problem, so it's going to keep affecting the recovery rate.
So we have a tweet from Patty who says, the problem is obviously hunting as a sport. But you stress, Kathy, that the effort to move away from lead ammunition is not anti-hunting. Tell us about that.
Right. It's not anti-hunting. It's really about what you use, in the weapon. There are options. There are non-lead options available now. But it's just going to take time for that to become, accepted.
Is it an easy ask to switch from lead to a non-lead option? Is it simple?
Well, it's been done, because non-lead ammunition is required for waterfowl and water bird hunting.
Okay.
Waterfowl, ducks, geese, rails. When you're hunting in wetlands, you do have to use non-lead alternatives. So they're out there, and that law was passed in 1991. So there are options. Some of the impediments are that the non-lead ammunition costs more. That cost has been coming down a little bit, but it is still a little bit more like premium ammunition. The problems right now is that the same as with everything else is with supply chain is that it's very hard to get any kind of ammunition.
So like a copper ammunition.
Lead and non-lead.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'd also read, too, that you're asking hunters that, if they can't or do not choose to switch ammunition, that if they're out in the field and there's something that's left over from the hunt, to bury it so that the eagles can't get at it. Is that the case?
Right. Yeah. And that is always advisable when hunting with lead. And it can be difficult if you're deer hunting. Most deer hunters want to field dress the deer in the field, meaning that you remove all the internal organs and leave them in the field. So ideally you would bury that and make it unavailable to eagles. But obviously it can be difficult if it's December and the ground's frozen.
Sure.
So another option is to take it out with you and just make sure that it doesn't get exposed to any kind of scavenging animals.
We have a question from Oliver who asks, was the lead poisoning also a problem during the DDT issues, or was it discovered only after the DDT was addressed? And has this been a problem for a while? What do you think?
I think it probably has been a problem for a long time, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because as long as you're hunting in the landscape and putting lead out into the landscape, I'm sure it has been a problem for a long time.
So when
DDT, of course, overwhelmed everything.
yeah. And again, with DDT, birds couldn't hatch their young because the shells were too thin, correct? The chemical caused the shells to become soft. Is that right?
Yeah, it interfered with the way calcium is processed in the body, and so the calcium was not laid down on the egg sufficiently.
Well, it's nice to hear that we have, what, I think over 200 nesting, 200 nests in New Jersey. I think we were down to one a half century ago, right?
Exactly. That's quite a huge growth curve and growth change over the last 50 years or so.
Yeah, encouraging. So, Kathy, what does treatment look like for lead? And what are the odds that a sick bird might make a full recovery?
It's tough. So the treatment, so the main thing is getting the bird to a wildlife rehabilitation center as soon as possible. The treatment is called chelation. It's basically like putting the bird through a bit of a carbon filtration system to remove that lead from the circulating blood. If it's too late, then and too much has reached the vital organs, then it's not going to work. Hmm. But the amazing kind of surprising to me what came out of the science paper, looking at birds that, you know, sampling birds that had died already, but also birds that were living and that we had blood samples from, that almost a third of eagles are showing almost acute levels of lead in their blood and liver samples. You know, liver samples are obviously taken from dead birds. Almost half of eagles are examined showed signs of chronic lead poisoning.
Are you discouraged in seeing these numbers?
Well, I think it's clear that we need to do something about this. When there's that much exposure that just keeps happening, and older birds show more signs of chronic poisoning because they are accumulating lead over their lifetime. And what we don't know at all is what are the effects of sublethal lead poisoning. So not the acute case. We know the acute case is probably going to, you know, kill the bird. Yeah. But, you know, something that is, you know, half of that level, it's not going to kill the bird, but it's going to impair the bird. And when we write our annual reports for our Eagle Project, we're documenting the number of birds that are encountered either they're treated in wildlife rehab centers or they're recovered dead. And we're doing those exams on those birds and also trying to identify the source or the cause of mortality. And now there's a lot of unknowns in our list. Of course, the top ones that we know about are vehicle strikes and electrocution. But you really have to wonder about, you know, even vehicle strikes and, of course, this larger category of about one-third of our eagles that we don't know the cause of death. The sublethal levels of lead are affecting their nervous systems and probably leading them to make poor decisions.
Poor decisions.
So we only have too close to vehicles.
We have about a half minute left. Mm-hmm. If someone were to see a bald eagle, which looks as if it's struggling, again, it's a huge bird with big talons, and that person might want to help. What would you recommend?
Well, the first thing they should do is just call the DEP hotline, and that's 877. And it spells out WARN DEP.
Okay.
And that way you can reach a dispatcher who can call one of our conservation police officers, and that would be the first thing I would recommend.
Okay, but don't try to physically handle one of these birds on your own. Call first.
The second option is you can call an avian wildlife rehabilitation center, and they can also give you advice if that is an option.
Got it. Kathy Clark, so good of you to join us. Such important information. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Kathy Clark is supervising biologist for the Endangered and Non-Game Species Program at the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez. Our producer is Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening, and be well.